The Immortal Game is a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year and is available in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 22, Home on the Range. I hit the bourbon hard when I got home, and the next morning I didn't exactly spring out of bed to do aerobics with the pretty girls wearing spandex on the TV fitness show. However, I did pay careful attention to their routines, particularly the stretches, while sitting on the couch in my boxer shorts eating raw Pop-Tarts. Who knew when I might get religion and take up strenuous exercise? I wanted to be prepared. I was tearing open a second foil package of Pop-Tarts when the bell from downstairs went off. I got up from the couch and buzzed open the door without thinking too much about it. Then I remembered the consequences of a similar decision just 3 nights ago, and I went back to the bedroom and got out the 9mm from its holster, where it hung on the bedpost. As I pulled open the apartment door in response to a sharp tap, I leveled the Glock at the belly button of the person in the hallway with a strawberry Pop-Tart clamped in my teeth.
"Don't shoot," said Lieutenant Stockwell. "I get killed in San Francisco by a guy in his underwear eating toaster pastry. St. Peter's going to send me straight to hell. There's no such thing as mitigating circumstances on a deal like that."
I lowered the gun and bit off a chunk of Pop-Tart I had between my teeth. I chewed it carefully and swallowed. "Sorry. I thought you were the Girl Scouts. They've really stepped up the pressure on the cookie racket lately." Stockwell bowled through the door and closed it behind him. He was wearing a dark suit with a tie that came closer to being fashionable than the one from the day before. His eyes measured the place.
"Jesus, Reardon. This dump is messier than my teenage kid's room. And what the hell are those things?"
He pointed at the Altec Lansings.
"Loudspeakers from the Paleolithic age?"
I turned heel on him and went into the bedroom, where I put the gun back in its holster and threw on my ratty bathrobe. When I returned, Stockwell was sweeping Pop-Tarts off the couch preparatory to sitting down. He looked edgy and uncomfortable. I pulled the high-back chair around to face him and fell into it. "So," I said, "did you come by to pass on some decorating tips, or did you have something else in mind? Yesterday you said you were too busy keeping your head above water to waste time dicking around with me. And then, by golly, you show up at my door. Miles out of your jurisdiction, even."
"Sure. Rub my nose in it. I didn't have to come here, and I damn well don't have to stay. But if you can keep your trap shut for a minute, there might be some advantage to it."
"All right, Lieutenant. I'm listening."
"Chuck Haystrup is dead."
I whistled under my breath. "How'd he get it?" Then, after thinking a bit, "Hold on. You members of the Fraternal Order of Law Enforcement don't think I had anything to do with it, do you? Because if that's your idea of an advantage, I don't see it."
"Got a guilty conscience, Reardon? They did tell me he has a broken nose."
"Nobody dies of a broken nose. A broken neck? A broken heart? Maybe. But not a broken nose. Now what's the story?"
"It's simple. He went to a South San Francisco shooting range this morning, rented a handgun, shot 3 rounds at a range target, then put the gun under his chin and capped himself."
I looked at Stockwell carefully. It occurred to me that this was some sort of trick. "No," I said. "I don't believe it. That's like a rattlesnake biting itself."
"If you don't believe me, then maybe you'll believe the videotape from the surveillance cameras. The whole thing is recorded on the first 10 minutes of today's log."
He stood up suddenly.
"They're holding things for me down at the range. Throw on some clothes and you can see for yourself."
This was getting stranger and stranger. "Why? Why include me on this?"
"I got my reasons. For now, let's just say that I need somebody who can ID the body. All we've got to go on is the stuff from his wallet. Let's go, Reardon. Chop, chop."
I got up and went to the bathroom. I did what I could at the basin with a washcloth and a comb, and then put on some clean clothes. Stockwell was pacing up and down in the living room when I came out.
"Come on," he said. "We'll take my car."
We went out and I locked the apartment door. As we were hustling down the stairs, I said, "I think I should just meet you there. That way you don't have to drive me back to the city."
"No, I don't have time for fooling around with two cars, and I don't want you showing up there first."
"Why ever not?" Stockwell stopped short on the stairs and I almost ran into him. He looked back at me.
"Listen, taking you to a crime scene isn't exactly playing it according to Hoyle. It's better if the South City cops think you're a detective on the EPA force. I don't want you to lie about it exactly, but I don't want you to do anything obvious to tip them off. Get it?"
I patted him on the shoulder. "I feel so proud. It will be an honor to serve with you on the East Palo Alto Police Force, Lieutenant."
"Shut up."
Stockwell had an unmarked Chevy that had seen better days. I let him ball himself up in the San Francisco traffic, trying to find one of the few freeway on-ramps they hadn't torn down with quake damage. After he got done cursing and pounding the dash, he finally did something productive and hit the siren, and then I directed him down 4th and the entrance to Highway 80. From there, we got on Highway 101 going south and drove less than 5 miles. The shooting range was on the freeway access road on the northbound side. It was one building and a strip of prefab tilt-ups that lined the road, and there were two South San Francisco patrol cars, an obvious unmarked car, and an ambulance parked in front. Stockwell flashed his badge to a uniformed cop who was guarding the door and asked for somebody named Lewinsky. The cop said, "Yeah, they've been waiting for you. He's in the office, talking to the manager. It's the door behind the front desk, just inside there." We went into the building. On the right was a reception counter with a cash register and a sign-in sheet. Behind that was a wall with cubbyholes, some open, some covered by locked doors. The open ones had earmuffs for protecting your hearing while shooting. I assumed the locked ones had guns for rent. Hanging from the ceiling was a TV monitor that cycled through different views of the shooting range every few seconds. One view showed a police officer looking down at something on the floor, just off camera. Stockwell and I went around the counter and through a door that opened in the back wall. Two men were in the room beyond. One was sitting in an elaborate ergonomic chair behind a modern-looking desk. He was bald, fat, and had a pitted face with a thin black mustache like a skid from a bicycle tire. He didn't look too happy. The other man was slouched in a plain chair in front of the desk, a leg dangling elaborately. He had blonde hair cut like a Marine's, a pinched nose, and a big, sloppy body.
"You the guys we're waiting on?" said the fat guy peevishly. "'Cause I got a senior's tourney in an hour, you know. I can't have these gray hairs waiting out in the parking lot while you haul this stiff out in a body bag. What would they think?"
"They might think they were witness to a tragedy of the sort caused by unrestricted access to handguns in America," said Stockwell.
"Yeah, right," said the fat guy. "More likely they'll just pee in their D-pens and cancel the tourney. And I can't afford that. So let's snap it up with this fancy-smancy detecting. The guy took a gun and blew his brains out. How hard can it be?"
The blonde guy stood up to face us. "I'm Lewinsky. You Stockwell?" Stockwell said he was and shook hands with Lewinsky.
"This is Reardon," said Stockwell, almost reluctantly.
That earned me a handshake with Lewinsky, too. Lewinsky gestured to the man behind the desk. "Meet Mr. Frankel. He's the manager of the shooting range. That gives him a particular interest in seeing that the wheels of justice turn quickly."
"So I noticed," said Stockwell. "How about we go and look at the body so you can move it out? Then we can take a gander at the other stuff."
"Fine by me," said Lewinsky. "This way to the main attraction." We went out of the office in a small procession and around the reception counter to a corridor that ran along the front of the building. We passed through a heavy door and continued down the corridor until we came to a set of stalls that looked out onto the range. Each stall had a pulley gizmo running along the ceiling to the back of the building to move paper targets to and from the range. There were also controls for running the pulley in each stall, and a metal bucket sitting on the floor in front to collect expended shell casings. There were numerous signs urging shooters to practice NRA rules for handgun safety, and reminding them to dump their shells in the bucket and not on the floor. The lighting was an intense fluorescent that made my hangover reassert itself with a passion. The thing on the floor didn't do a whole lot of good either. Chuck Haystrup had fallen backwards after he shot himself, and as a result, was lying face up with his arms and legs spread like a kid making angels in the snow. He was wearing the same white clothing he was on the night he jumped me, but there was nothing else angelic about him. Under his chin was a nasty blackened hole with a trickle of dried blood that ran down his neck and led to a coagulated pool on his sternum.
A strip of adhesive tape over a misshapen nose marked his last encounter with me. His eyes were wide open in a startled expression, and he had a shrunken, wizened appearance that made him look like an old man who'd been surprised in a horrific fall down the stairs. As for the top of his head, it simply wasn't there. The cop I'd seen on the TV monitor was leaning on the counter of the stall in front of Haystrip, watching our approach. A couple of paramedics sat on a bench further down the corridor, their wheeled gurney standing next to them. One of us in the procession, very likely me, must have looked a little green, because the cop waiting for us said, "Please be sure to place your expended shell casings and the contents of your stomach in the metal buckets, not on the floor." "Thank you for that, Butch," said Lewinsky. He turned to us. "The lab ghoulies have already come and gone, but this is pretty much how we found him. Does he look like the guy you're interested in?" Stockwell looked over at me. "That's him," I said. "Or at least most of him." "Yeah, well, they already cleaned up the rest of his brain," said Lewinsky. "Sorry about that. We also got his wallet, some other stuff in his pockets, and the gun he rented. A Ruger Blackhawk 44 Magnum."
"Christ," said Stockwell. "He used enough gun, didn't he? Isn't that one of those Wild West revolvers?"
"That's right," agreed Lewinsky. "They writ all kinds of shit here. And if you look above you at about 11 o'clock, you'll see where the slug went into the ceiling, still zipping along after it took off his brain pan." Stockwell and I looked up at the hole. It was about a foot away from one of the surveillance cameras.
"Ain't physics wonderful?" said Stockwell. "What's next on the tour?"
"We can show you the videotape, I guess," said Lewinsky. "Then you can look at the stuff we took off the body." Lewinsky shouted down to the paramedics. "Okay, you guys can take him now." One paramedic started wheeling the gurney towards us, while the other stood up and looked at Lewinsky with a wise-ass expression. "So, Sarge," he said, "you want us to say he died on the way to the hospital like usual, so you don't have to mess with the paperwork?" Lewinsky reddened. The cop leaning on the counter smothered a grin. "That little bastard," said Lewinsky in an undertone. "You know how it goes. If they die in the wagon, it saves you about 2 hours of paperwork. So once in a while we get them to take a fresh one on board and say that he croaked on the way. Nothing like this, of course."
"I know the drill," said Stockwell.
Lewinsky and Stockwell started back up the corridor, but I lingered to talk to the paramedics. "You guys know Ronan O'Grady in San Francisco?" I asked them. "He's in your biz." O'Grady and I had played jazz together in a couple of pickup sessions. Both men had come up with a gurney now and were pulling on rubber gloves. The one who had mouthed off said, "That Irish pirate? Of course we know him. We see him drinking at the Rat and Raven almost every week." "Well, tell him Reardon says hello." I looked down at the gurney where the plastic body bag was already unzipped and waiting. A tag on the zipper read, "Caution, biohazard." "What's with the tag?" I asked, curious. "It's nothing," said the other paramedic. "It's standard operating procedure nowadays."
"Hey, Reardon," yelled Stockwell from the door leading to the reception area. "Let's get with the program here."
I jogged up to the door. "Gee," I said when I reached him, "I hope you're not going to report me to the chief of detectives." He glared at me and mouthed the words, "Eat shit." Lewinsky was waiting for us in the reception area when we came through the door. He was monkeying around with a videotape machine on a shelf below the counter. "Now," he said, "I think I've got it queued up to the place we want. Take a look at the monitor." We did, and it wasn't pretty. Watching Haystrip kill himself was twice as bad as looking at the dead body afterwards. The tape had a gritty, surreal, this-can't-be-happening aura. It reminded me of the footage from the Vietnam War of the South Vietnamese officer executing a Viet Cong prisoner. As the tape started, Haystrip was loading the revolver with cartridges from a box. The gun was a monster. Black, long-barreled, with a distinctive curved hammer of a Western-style six-shooter. Haystrip snapped the cylinder of the gun in place and pressed a button to send a paper target attached to the pulley mechanism to the back of the range. He didn't appear nervous or tentative in any way. Just another pedestrian day on the shooting range. He fired 3 rounds at the target, pausing to take careful aim before each shot. There was still nothing out of the ordinary about his actions, except that he hadn't bothered to put on hearing protection before shooting. Then, in one movement, as if part of a standard routine, Haystrip took the gun with both hands and shoved its barrel under his chin. Given the placement of the camera, All we could see was Haystrup standing upright, his elbows sticking out at his side, his head tilted back slightly. It almost looked like a yoga position. Until he pulled the trigger. The top of his head vaporized in an instant, and Haystrup seemed to jump backwards as the force of the slug launched him off his feet. The camera shook as the bullet embedded itself in the ceiling. Then there was nothing but a wisp of drifting smoke. The body and the blood in the viscera on the floor could not be seen. Lewinsky shut off the videotape machine. We all stood silent, avoiding each other's eyes.
"My God," said Stockwell finally. "Talk about being cold-blooded. He did it like he was flipping a light switch."
"He probably knew he was being taped," said Lewinsky. "Wanted to put on a good final show." "I was wondering about that," I said. "Why do they run the cameras in here?"
Lewinsky smiled grimly. "Guess you haven't been reading the police wire much, bud. Shooting range suicides are the new thing. There's been about 4 in the last year. The range owners have put in cameras to monitor the customers, but it really doesn't do much for prevention. Ends up being a good way for the owners to protect themselves from lawsuits, though. Hard to argue your loved one died as a result of negligence when you look at something like that."
"You probably didn't have a lot of loved ones in the first place if you do that to yourself," said Stockwell.
The paramedics came by with a gurney and wheeled Haystrup out the door into the parking lot. Stockwell watched them absently, then said,
"Okay, let's wrap this up. You got the stuff from the body, you said. No suicide note, I take it."
Lewinsky kicked at a gray evidence lockbox on the floor. He opened the hinge lid and took out several plastic bags containing personal articles.
"No," he said, "no note. We got his wallet, keys, some change, and some breath mints. That's it."
"Breath mints," I said. "Then it is true what they say. It is always important to have fresh breath." Stockwell looked at me with a martyred expression.
"I knew you were going to let that one pass."
He turned back to Lewinsky. "The keys fit any of the cars in the lot?"
"No, there were no cars we couldn't account for after we sent all the other customers packing. The manager thinks Haystrup may have taken a cab here anyway."
"I suppose that makes sense," said Stockwell. "Why leave any more loose ends than you have to? Well, how's to rifle the wallet? Or have you already done that?"
"Sure, we looked through it. It was pretty slim pickings." Lewinsky put on a pair of plastic gloves from the lockbox and took the wallet from its bag. He pulled out all the cards, money, and other papers it contained and spread them out on top of the counter. He was right. It was pretty slim pickings. I saw just 2 things of interest. One was a snapshot of Terry McCullough, very similar to the one Bishop had given me, and the other was a business card. The card was for a guy named Dale Pace, who was in the used car business. Haystrup had said the black guy who helped work me over was named Dale, so I figured it belonged to him. I pointed at Terry's picture. "There's your gal, Stockwell."
"Yeah," he said. "I know it. Can you flip it over for us, Lewinsky? I want to see if there's anything written on the back."
Lewinsky flipped it and the back was clean.
"That it?" said Lewinsky. "Just let me copy down the stuff on the business card and you can pack it up," said Stockwell.
He took a small notebook and pen from his breast pocket and wrote down the information.
"Wait a minute," he said. "Reardon, you know who that card belongs to?"
"Yeah, probably. I think it's the guy who participated in the assault and battery with Haystrup."
"Great. Thanks for coming across with that so quickly."
"Don't worry, Lieutenant. I would have told you back at the station house."
Stockwell narrowed his eyes at me. "Okay, I think that covers it for us," he said. "I appreciate your holding things until we got here, Lewinsky. I'll be in touch about the lab work and such."
Lewinsky took off the plastic gloves and reached over to shake Stockwell's hand again.
"No problem. Happy to help. Good luck on the teller kill.
And I'll give you or Reardon here a call when we get the lab work back."
"Call me," said Stockwell quickly. "Reardon isn't going to be working on this case any longer."
"Yep," I said. "Got me a cush assignment guarding the mayor's 18-year-old daughter. You see, she's been getting these threatening calls from..."
"Let's get going," said Stockwell.
He hustled me out the door and we walked back to his car without any more conversation. Once inside, I said, "Okay, let's have it. You didn't take me down there to be a nice guy. Maybe you needed me to identify the body, but that could have waited." Stockwell rubbed his face with both hands and looked out the window, not seeing anything. I noticed for the first time how worn he looked.
"I need to go over something with you," he said. "There's been a development. A development that doesn't exactly fit with my take on the homicide. Nothing totally out of whack, you understand, but enough to get me thinking.
He looked over, expecting me to say, "Neener, neener," or some equally mature remark in the "I told you so" line. I was tempted, but I didn't want him to clam up on me. "What kind of development?" I asked.
"I got the lab report back from the murder scene. They dusted for fingerprints like they always do. Hers are all over the apartment, of course. Teller's are there in several places. The refrigerator door, the beer bottle, the photograph you said he was holding when you walked in."
But not enough places for him to have been over there before. Not enough places for him to have been having an affair with her.
"Yeah, probably," said Stockwell. "But that's not where I'm going with this. If they were having an affair, they could have been meeting in hotels. Who'd want to have sex in that dump? No, the point is they found another print. A print we can't identify."
"You're sure it's not one of mine?"
Stockwell snorted. "No, it's not one of yours. Of course, we did find yours all over the fucking place, Reardon. If we were going by volume, you'd be the one having an affair with her."
I knew better than to respond to that. "All right, then. So what's the big deal on the mystery print? Could it have been left by a friend? Could it have been left by the landlady? She seems like the sort to snoop."
"The big deal is it was found on the framed photograph the teller was holding. The photograph, you may not have noticed, that was back on the shelf by the time we got to the apartment. And it ain't the landlady's."
"I see what you're driving at. You think somebody else was in the apartment that night and picked up the photograph and put it back on the shelf."
"I suppose that could be."
"It could also be that Terry McCullough put it back that night, and that the print is from a friend who handled it before."
Stockwell pounded on the steering wheel. "Here I am providing evidence to shore up your cockamamie theory of a different killer, one, by the way, that I still don't buy, and here you are arguing the other way. The print was found on the surface of the photograph, under the place where the glass broke off, and it seems to be fresh."
"Oh.
Believe me, I know that doesn't prove anything conclusively. We don't know how long McCullough had the photograph, who developed it, who framed it, etc. But what I need confirmed is that you really did see Teller drop the photograph and that neither of you picked it up and put it back on the shelf."
"He dropped it all right. And neither of us was exactly in a good housekeeping frame of mind. It stayed on the floor for as long as I stayed conscious."
Stockwell took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "Okay, then," he said. "Thank you. You got any other niggling contradictions you want to talk over?"
Stockwell gave me a searching look.
"Chuck Haystrip's doing-yourself brain surgery in there isn't a contradiction?"
"Sure. I said as much in my apartment, didn't I? You think it's tied in with Teller's murder?"
"Well, I'm sure as hell going to check his prints against the one on the photograph. Maybe he was the one who came up from behind you at McCullough's place. Maybe he whacked Teller that night and got to feeling guilty about it later."
I mulled that one over. It was an idea that had crossed my mind. "I like him because Terry McCullough has used him for all our other heavy lifting," I said. "But I can't see him offing himself over guilt. And that photograph, he could..."
Stockwell cut me off. "Don't say it. He could have put his print on there before. Give your skepticism a rest, will you, Reardon? I'm not building the whole case around the photo."
I let him cool off. "Anything else?" I asked after a decent interval.
He started to say something, but then bit back the words. "No, that's it."
He put the key in the ignition switch and started the motor.
"Let's blow," he said abruptly.
There was clearly more that was bothering Stockwell, but I didn't have much luck wheedling it out of him on the drive home. I regretted my remarks about the photograph because it made him reluctant to discuss anything else I might judge far-fetched. He did tell me that no one had brought in Todd Nagel for questioning, and that the Bay Area, and now state a nationwide hunt for Terry McCullough, had turned up exactly zilch. Stockwell dropped me off in front of my building at about 1:30. I did my ritual with the Samuel Jeweler street clock, and then rode the elevator up to my office.
You have been listening to The Immortal Game, a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year. Find it in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.